and Internet Seminar. Our live broadcast today will cover sustainable remediation and has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be serving as the online moderator for today's. In just a few moments, I'll turn things over to Carlos Pachon, who will be helping me introduce the various speakers on today's session. Before we begin the technical portion for the broadcast, let me cover a few minor housekeeping and reminder items for today's session. For those of you that might be new to our Clulin webinars and aren't quite sure what to do, I just wanted to remind everyone you should have received a reminder email that has the instructions you'll need to join us for today's live broadcast. That reminder email will point you to something known as our seminar homepage, where you can read more about the broadcast, find contact information for our presenters, download presentation materials, browse other links and items that have been pulled together by our organizers, even provide feedback after the live event. For now, you'll want to click a button labeled Go to Seminar in the upper left corner of that page. Once you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name, and you'll be checked in and brought to our live Adobe Connect room that we'll be using for today's session. Our entire broadcast will be offered online live, so you can sit back and watch in real time as our speakers deliver their talks from various locations around the world. You'll be able to both see and hear through your computer or mobile device. You'll also have the opportunity to vote in interactive polls like you should see in the bottom left half of your screen right now. If you have difficulties joining us in this live Adobe Connect environment, please know you can simply download the slides and join us on the telephone line, but there may be some interactive components that you miss out on. So we encourage you to let us know if you're having any technical problems, and we'll be more than happy to troubleshoot them with you. Audio is available online by default for all participants. If you have problems with the online audio, first check your local volume settings on your own computer or mobile device. Sometimes it's a matter of simply boosting your speaker output. If that fails to solve any audio issues, please let me know. We do have toll-free call-in information for both the United States as well as other international participants. You may use the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right-hand corner, to request the call-in number at any time. Just know if you join us on the phones, we are asking everyone to remain muted to cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. As I mentioned, there's a Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a welcome message in that window. In fact, for those of you who may be new, I encourage you to take a moment to test out the Q&A window now. Feel free to click your mouse cursor on the empty box at the bottom of the Q&A window, where you should be able to type in a message. Feel free to say hello and let me know how the audio and visuals are coming through. That tool will be the primary way we will collect your questions and comments. It's also the way you can submit technical problems. So if you need anything at any point, please use the Q&A window to request it. Our session today is being recorded and will automatically be archived. You'll be able to access the archives in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. And again, we'll send you an email with complete instructions on how to access that archive. But for those of you who can't wait, you can browse the nearly 600 archived Clulin webinars that we currently have available. This is a brief screenshot of what you all should be looking at. The main portion of your screen will primarily show a copy of our presentation slides. Our instructors will control movement through the deck. So if you have any problems viewing the content, you may want to download a copy of the slides from the seminar resources area and either print them out or flip through them locally. And then along the right side, you will see our Clulin logo in the upper right. Our collection of related URLs appears in the middle right. Again, you can open up any one of these websites by clicking on it and pressing the Browse To button to open up those websites locally. And then, of course, that interactive Q&A window in the lower right, you can type your questions or comments here and hit Enter or press the cartoon bubble to the right, and that'll privately submit your questions and comments. Again, in the lower left half of your screen, you may see some interactive polls appear, so this is just one more call to remind our participants. We do have an interactive poll that's appearing in the lower left half of your screen. To vote, simply click on the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your reply. And you will all be able to see each other's, you'll see the distribution of votes. So for right now, it looks like almost half of our audience is actually coming in from the consulting or engineering sector. And about 20% is a regulatory agency. We have about 10% as an actual state owner. 10% are coming in from municipality or other government agencies. And then the other 11% are coming in from another organization. So you will see those types of polls pop up periodically. All right, Carlos, I think that's the end of the general reminders I have for everyone. So I'll go ahead and turn things over to you and so we can introduce our first speaker.
Thank you, Jean. I'm going to go ahead and Okay, I'll introduce Dietmar. I did want to mention, first, thank everybody for joining us today on this webinar. We have a great set of speakers, and speaking from multiple places around the world. Our first is Dietmar Mueller, who's with the Austrian EPA. He's speaking from Vienna, and he is currently deputy head of Department for Contaminated Sites, supervising the national program and acting as associated expert to the Austrian government, Austrian Parliament's Commission on the Remediation of Contaminated Sites. Dietmar was the host of the previous Sustainable Remediation Conference, which was held in Vienna in 2012. And from 2005 until 2013, he acted as secretary for EuroDemo, which is a network aiming to stimulate demonstration projects on innovative technologies and sustainable practices for remediation. So with that, I'll hand it over to Dietmar. Thank you.
Thanks, Carlos. Thanks, Jean. Welcome on behalf of Environment Agency Austria. Well, Vienna was privileged in 2012 to be the second station of kind of a concert of voices engaging in green and sustainable remediation. And that's why it's my role for the webinar to give a brief global roundup for the different initiatives and also kind of signposting for resources and developments since the Vienna conference. So what I will be doing is going from east to west, from Asia crossing Europe to the Americas, and providing also some remarks on the transcontinental efforts which are nowadays ongoing. Starting from Asia and Australia, it's SURF Australia and New Zealand, which is a collaborative forum of the industry, regulatory and academic consultancy members, founded in 2009 and established as a working group within the Australasian Land and Groundwater Association. By this year, definitely upcoming should be SURF China, which is a collaboration of three engineering centers, a platform of those, and organized through the Institute of Soil Sciences at the University of Nanjing, which is called SciTrem. Finally, there is SURF Taiwan, since 2012, established also as a working group within a national association on soil and groundwater protection again. There also you see the remark of the first with regard to international cooperation, so there will be something on the West Coast in the U.S. in August this year. So for the Asian part, up to now it's Australia and New Zealand, which are probably the leading part, so they are of course doing the same thing, like giving the right backgrounds, doing the kind of policy science integration. What I want to point on is, in particular for recent developments, they are establishing their policy in consultation with the members, and they're really looking out for an online dialogue. I think that's very much about sustainable remediation, is the dialogue part and the participatory approach. Moving on to Europe, you see the Common Forum, the NICOL, which are two networks, transnational networks in Europe, Common Forum, a regulators network since the mid of the 90s, NICOL following up end of the 90s as an industry and business network, and started by SURF UK in 2007, there are nowadays three national SURF organizations. SURF UK is basically working with projects and involves all the stakeholders over there. SURF NL, SURF Dutch, is an informal Dutch network since 2011. It includes, of course, all the stakeholders from consultants until research institutes, industry, and so on. SURF Italy is established in 2012, kind of a follow-up also maybe to the Vienna conference, which brought about the establishment. Looking for what has been achieved since Vienna, so there has been a workshop on green remediation organized by Nicole, and within this workshop, or until this workshop, Nicole, the industry network, and Common Forum, the regulators network, managed to agree on a joint position statement on sustainable remediation, and also to cover a bridging from risk-based and sustainable, clarifying that these are not contrary concepts, but complementary concepts. What is the particular also on the joint position statement is you already have it available to 5 languages. What is upcoming, or what Common Forum is started to discuss, is about public procurement, that is further key for sustainable remediation, and with this line submitted also a project proposal to the European Commission just a few weeks ago. The central, the core of sustainable remediation in Europe is SURF-OK. So just highlighting the achievements since Vienna again, which was the phase three. So phase three was the third project in line, the results. The SURF lookout, you may look out for the SURF-UK bulletin 4, which gives the overview and the different project products like the sustainable management practices, the project framing guidance, and already the tier one qualitative assessment guidance. What is of particular importance, also as discussed in Vienna, is that they also put online the first case studies by last year, which provide a very important orientation for future demonstrations. So crossing the Atlantic to the Americas, there are governmental bodies, USEPA, obviously, the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, and Environment Canada, and also a precursor, of course, SURF since 2006, SURF Brazil and SURF Canada, as well as ASTM. So for the different networks, it's also kind of including all the actors inside remediation, and for getting there on the achievements during the last year, it's to point to that SURF had publications by last year, so it's about the integration of remediation and reuse to achieve a whole system sustainability benefits and groundwater conservation, and it's about that ASTM managed to get on the first standard guides, one for integrating sustainable objectives into cleanup, and as well a standard guide for greener cleanups, and I guess Carlos will work out on this. Finally, transcontinental efforts are also again largely organized by the UK, so it's CARE. I forgot about that. CARE is in the core of UK SURF. CARE is a non-profit organization organizing not only the SURF UK, but also the International SURF Network, which is providing an information exchange by quarterly having a telephone conference and updating on the different new products. As well as the ISO, International Organization for Standardization, started an effort and working group drafting a guidance on sustainable remediation, and again led by the UK in the person of Paul Nathaniel from the University of Nottingham and Land Quality Management. Yeah, that's it. So what SUSTREM, what Vienna supported is hopefully to strengthen the global exchange. What is really a great outcome for Europe, at least, is in position of Nicole and Common Forum to have a common ground for industry and the regulators to understand sustainable remediation. SURF Italy was a follow-up, and from conceptual discussions, we are moving to practice and we are looking out for case studies. So finally, I want to stress on the innovation curve, handing over also to the colleagues from Italy. So innovation is always very much about people, so I'm really looking forward to the next conference in Ferrara. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Dietmar. We will be taking questions at the end of having some discussion at the end of the presentations. As you notice, this is a very compressed event. It's only an hour, though we may spill over with questions and answers. We've purposely done that, and we limit to very short briefings. So any questions for Dietmar, participants, feel free to ask him on the Q&A on your screen or ask him verbally at the end of the speakers when Gene will be moderating the discussion. So with that, my name is Carlos Pachon. I'm with EPA's Superfund program here in Washington, D.C. It's my pleasure to be here with you today, and I've been asked to give a little bit of an update on what the state of the practice is with respect to green and remediation and the broader concept of green and sustainable remediation. So I'll be covering four main areas in the little 10 minutes I have, well, not little, in the generous 10 minutes I have. The first I want to discuss some trends in technology selection in Superfund and what the implications are for green remediation practices. While I will be speaking pretty much from, I guess, of my experience at EPA, I hope that some of the findings I discuss are general to the whole sector, for all the practice. I'll then be talking about some recent developments in technical tools and guidance, and some examples of what is happening in the field. I struggled with that because I was very tempted to go into some very specific and technical examples, but I decided to follow an alternative approach. With that, I'll give you a one-screen summary of what I just described, and from then I'll hand it over to our next speaker. Before I jump into the first slide, I did want to make a bit of a challenge, and that is that, you know, in the United States and across I've, you know, had the opportunity of hearing directly from remediation market regulators in countries such as Australia, including China, including Brazil, of course, most of Europe. And I know that remediating contaminated sites is going to be still a challenge for us because there's a lot of work to be done going forward. However, at the same time, we have been working on this for quite a few years, and we have gained a lot of experience. The question is, how can we apply the lessons learned in what we've achieved so far going forward and achieve that protectiveness to human health and the environment from cleanup contaminated sites, achieving that with a lower environmental footprint? So that's, I guess, ultimately what a shared goal many of us have. With respect to how we clean up contaminated sites, I decided to share a couple of slides from a recent report that we produced here in a Superfund program, which shows the trends in remedy selection in our program. This first slide, basically what you see are three lines that are more or less parallel, up and down a little bit over the years, but pretty much parallel. What this represents is the selection of treatment technologies, which is this green line here, of containment technologies, which is the orange line, and other remedies, which include things like institutional control in Superfund. The point to make is that we continue to use about 40% of our remedies are source treatment, which tend to be more aggressive, tend to be more resource intensive, tend to get us, you know, for example, concentration or toxicity reductions. We continue to have a lot of containment remedies, which includes dig and haul, and at least in our definition. So we continue to move a lot of soil. And then that there's the point to make is that there's no magic bullet. There is no green remediation technology out there. It's about how we build and operate our current portfolio of technologies. That was looking at soil. If we go to the next slide, this represents the groundwater remedies used in the Superfund program. Again, from this report that we released in at the end of the last year, here at the bottom of the screen is a URL if you want to get the full report. This is taken from Figure 11, and these are remedies applied to groundwater. And again, as we saw with soil or source remedies, we see after about 2001 a certain level, a certain degree of continuity in the mix of remedies. What we have is pump and treat in blue, we have in-situ treatment in light green, and we have monitor natural attenuation in orange, and some others, vertical engineer barriers at the bottom here. But mainly what we see here is continuity in the mix of those three main categories, pump and treat, in-situ treatment, and monitor natural attenuation. We do, however, see a trend, increasing trend in in-situ treatment, which seems to be continuing and moving positively forward. So overall, as with this, source control remedies, there's a continuity in the mix of the remedies we are using out there. However, we are getting better in designing and building these remedies. And that's the next point I want to make with respect to those concepts of green and sustainable remediation. That looking for achieving a low environmental footprint and how we protect human health and environment is definitely consistent with science and engineering principles, and as we mentioned, the lessons learned today. We can achieve large footprint reductions from accurate and continuously updated conceptual site models, understanding where the contaminant is in the media and how it is behaving. From that, we also, what contributing to that are well-characterized source areas and contaminant plumes. That's an area we are working with, we're working very closely in, and concepts such as high-resolution site characterization that help us pinpoint and surgically design and build treatment remedies. However, there are many remedies that have been around for a long time, such as pump and treat systems, which can operate for many years. In that case, we're looking at optimizing those systems, revisiting them, and seeing that they're optimized so they continue to provide protectiveness, often with a smaller environmental footprint. For new remedies, of course, we look at sound engineering design, ensuring that all remedy components work well together, and that going forward, we streamline performance monitoring to see how they are doing. And based on the information from that performance monitoring, we might engage in adaptive management, where with certain remedy components we might be turning down or turning off and relying more on others. With all that, having done all that, that's when we really come in and once again focus on greening the resulting remedy. So let's not green a remedy that's not efficient. Let's design efficient remedies and look at what we can do additionally to reduce their environmental footprint. This is a bit of a reminder slide in case somebody is still not familiar with our concepts of green remediation. This is what we call the core elements of green remediation and what in general we try to achieve with respect to them. That's with respect to energy, use less energy, more efficient systems, and use renewables where possible. In air quality, protecting air quality, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. For water, use less water, reuse the water that's been treated, and avoid, minimize impacts on surface water qualities. Similar with the land and ecosystems, and with materials and waste, the classic minimize, reuse, and recycle. Okay, so now I move on to the next section, a few things, updates I want to touch on technical guidance tools for implementation, some that are newer, some that are out there, but whose use is expanding. The first one here in the U.S., I wanted to highlight the standard guide for greener cleanups, which Dietmar mentioned earlier. This is a voluntary guide that was released in November of this year. It basically lays out approaches for selecting best management practices that can help us reduce the environmental footprint of cleanup projects. And it includes the option of using quantitative methods to better define what that environmental footprint is. It also specifies a documentation of the actions taken. Myself and some colleagues participated in the ASTM workgroup that developed this guide, and that was one of our areas of interest, is ensuring that there's robust documentation of what is achieved through the implementation of this voluntary guide. Our assistant administrator here in EPA for the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, who oversees all cleanup programs in EPA, sent out a memorandum in December encouraging its use in all cleanup programs. And for those of you who have interest on April 25th of this month, in 10 days, we have a webinar co-sponsored with ASTM on the standard guide. Another area to highlight are environmental footprint tools. These tend to be more involved, require a little bit more work. They're very important for large projects where we want to understand the remedies footprint and contributors to that footprint. Excuse me, Gina, I was wondering if you could do a global mute and I could unmute myself or?
Certainly, Carlos, I can do that. I'm going to put the audience on a global mute. Everyone will hear a message that global mute has been enabled, and I'll help the instructors out if we need to get off the global mute.
Thank you.
The leader has muted your line. To unmute your line, press #6.
Okay, hello, so Carlos, I've muted your line. Carlos, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go on. Thank you.
Thank you. So these are footprint tools. I'm listing a few of four main groups. The first is the EPA, the updated EPA methodology spreadsheets, working with our colleagues in EPA Region 9. We produced a methodology in 2012, I think it was released, and associated spreadsheets for environmental footprint analysis. We're currently in the process of updating those. There are also two major tools on the market. One is the Battelle SiteWise tool, which its development was co-sponsored by Navy and Army and others, and it's in use by those two Department of Defense agencies. There's also the U.S. Air Force Sustainable Remediation Tool, which focuses more on specific remedies, whereas the previous two might focus more on footprint elements. There are also numerous proprietary tools on the market and some that are developed for in-house use by consulting and engineering firms. And finally, I did not list it, I should have done so, but there's the life cycle assessment tools that can be brought in from other sectors such as product development tools that help with that can be applied to remediation as well. And a final tool for implementation, which may seem a little bit abstract, but we're finding it very useful, is we continue to look across different agencies, state, federal, et cetera, what contracting language is being used when remediation is contracts are put in place to seeking that projects be undertaken consistent with either green remediation principles in general, or maybe more specifically, either the ASTM standard guide or conducting environmental footprints and taking action on the findings. Okay, so what are we seeing in the field? I guess a little bit of a recap, although we'll get to that later. We are seeing that at our projects that conduct environmental footprint quantification helps target best management practices to address key contributors. So sometimes those best management practices may have a cost, not insignificant cost implication, or we may not know exactly what the key remedy contributor is to a certain footprint element, or even which are the most important footprint elements in a remedy. That's what we're finding is the advantage of conducting those footprint quantifications to help target those BMPs and the remedy components that are contributing to the footprint. Green remediation is being embedded into project management processes. We discussed that earlier. For new remedies, footprint reductions can be achieved through focus design. For existing remedies, we can do optimization. And then, of course, across the board, protecting human health and environment are still key drivers in remedy decisions. As I mentioned earlier, as far as expanding practice and expectations, I had done a quick Google search of green remediation. And after skimming through, these are some of the larger, some of the firms that popped up as having websites on web pages on their websites defining or describing the types of green remediation experience, practice, and expertise they're able to offer. I also included two little slides on the bottom right-hand corner. These are more maybe site owners that also describe what they have been able to achieve at some of their cleanup projects. So that's a bit of representation, probably underrepresentation of what one may call demand pool. Also wanted to mention really quickly the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. That is an EPA perspective. We definitely believe in the quote-unquote triple bottom line With respect to Superfund, we are focusing on green remediation, on the environmental aspects of cleanups, because we have existing protocols to address social and economic considerations. For example, on the economic side, we have the Superfund redevelopment initiatives, and one of the reuse is certainly a priority in cleaning up contaminated sites. In fact, reasonably anticipated reuse is one of the considerations in selecting cleanup remedies in Superfund. Also wanted to mention, of course, is community involvement. EPA has the Superfund program has a very active community involvement program. It's actually written into the law. So we have protocols in place to consider economic redevelopment at sites and social, considering the interests of the communities where those cleanups are taking place. And we encourage that others look at those. So wrapping up here, options for implementing green remediation. In our case, we can go straight to best management practices. I have a list of some of the fact sheets we've put together on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, possibly go through quantification if necessary to better understand what our footprint is. So in summary, green remediation is not a new technology, but an improvement to the existing portfolio of remediation options. Awareness and use of green remediation best management practices is expanding in most cleanup programs for both large and small sites. It is not a regulatory requirement, but a practice many entities pursue in line with their sustainability objectives, and that's often on the demand side. We know that consulting engineering firms are increasingly incorporating green remediation BMPs into standard operations, and a large body of green remediation technical resources is now available, and multiple groups are involved in advancing the practice. So thank you. I believe I might have run over a little bit, so I'll hand it right over to our next speaker. Please let me confirm. Marco, are you going to speak now?
It's Claudio starting.
Oh, okay, Claudio. So if we introduce Claudio, I believe Claudio is speaking from Milan, Italy. He is with CH2M Hill. He is currently International Project Delivery Leader and Sustainable Remediation Expert for their office. He's a member of SURF Italy, founding member of SURF Italy, and chair in January of 2013. Claudio, I appreciate your time. I hand it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Carlos, and I would like to thank both you and Jean for hosting this webinar. And on behalf of SURF Italy, I think this is a very good opportunity. And danke to Dietmar for supporting the launch of SURF on the early stage. This is really appreciated. This very brief presentation from myself and Marco Falconi. Marco Falconi, also one of the founding members of SURF Italy, as well as technical with the Italian EPA called ISPRA, and professor at university on various sustainable and green remediation practices. So this brief presentation will be about introduction of our conference, which is going to be held in Ferrara in September 2014, continuing the path started in Copenhagen and then in Vienna. So the presentation outline is kind of brief. We're going to talk about how the Sustainable Remediation Conference 2014 was determined and what the current organization status. And then I will pass the word over to Marco for describing some of the host country goals. So again, after the initial step towards sustainable remediation initiated in Copenhagen in Denmark in 2009, and then the second event hosted by Dietmar in Vienna in 2012, we're very proud that Italy has been accepted as hosting the next conference on sustainable remediation occurring in mid of September 2014 in the wonderful Ferrara. And you can see here the homepage of the website. If you didn't have the chance of visiting the website, I really encourage you because it includes a lot of information about this this conference and registration and abstract information. So you please do that. The Sustainable Remediation 2014 conference organization is here summarized. Surf Italy, which I have the honor of representing as current chairman, is a working group within the RECONNET, which is the Italian Network for Contaminated Land Management, which is a volunteer organization including a number of public authorities, research institutes, as well as industry and consultants. And we have the pleasure of working on this event together with the Remtec Ferrara Fiere, who is going to be the venue where the conference is going to be hosted, and as well as continuing from Vienna, US EPA, CLARE, and Austrian EPA are part of the organizing committee. And we have a wealth of international partner organization, from Common Forum to Nicole to a number of Asian entities, which are supporting us in the effort of organizing, preparing, and selecting the best abstract for this conference. So we are really glad about this international support to the conference. Next slide introduce briefly the themes, the topics which are going to be covered during the conference, and are going to be kind of split in the various abstract and presentation in sessions within the conference. So as you can see, we are moving from very high level and general topics related to sustainable remediation conceptual framing to tools, metrics, and indicators that are available on the market, as Carlos already introduced, and maybe we'll discover new ones that are not still very well known to the public. We will describe and evaluate and understand how is greening remediation, what are eco-efficient technologies and opportunities from synergies in order to combine environmental footprint and cost effectiveness and obtain an overall benefit. Of course, case study is a relevant portion of our combined effort, as we want to demonstrate and understand what is already occurring, and what are good cases that can help us moving forward as good examples. And finally, we already realized that a key success factor for sustainable remediation is a proactive stakeholder engagement and involvement and participation. So what are the key triggers, the challenges, and the opportunities for making this as a wealthy success? And I think today's webinar is already a very good stakeholder engagement given the various source and origin of the speaker, and I'm sure about also the attendance. Getting to the next slide, some elements of the program. The registration for the conference is open online since early January and will be open till pretty much the date of the conference. The current deadline for submittal of abstract is April 25th, so not very far away from today, but we are currently considering extending the abstract submittal deadline to allow more practitioners to contribute, because we realize that everybody's really busy and we don't want to give the excuse of people being too busy to submit this abstract, which we think are going to be relevant and interesting for everybody to attend and to learn from. Depending on the abstract submission deadline, the confirmation of acceptance will be in the May period. Then the conference will be a 3 days, 2.5 days conference. The first day will be hosted in the wonderful Ferrara Castle, which is downtown, and you can see a couple of pictures of where the location is going to look like. Whereas the second and third day are going to be in the main modern exhibition district. And we are really looking forward to having a lot of attendance and participants. I hope these elements that I provided are sufficient for convincing you to attend, submitting abstract and registering. But if not, I'm glad to pass the word to Marco, since he's going to add some more feeling of the host country goals and the challenges that we like to bring forward. So thank you, Marco. Hello, Marco?
Marco, you might be muted. Gene, what's the unmute option?
That's right. Marco, you may need to hit #6 to unmute.
Hello, I'm Marco speaking. Thank you, Claudio. I will try to show in the second part of the presentation the Italian country goals, how the legislation already includes provisions for green practice, how these provisions are not reflecting in the technologies used in the remediation at the time being. Country goals, promote sustainable remediation experience from lessons learned, case studies and governance at the international level, witness and support the continuous improvement in sustainable remediation practice, spread the concept of green and sustainable remediation among Italian stakeholders. Many Italian firms have the word sustainability in their code of ethics and in their mission statements, but sometimes they don't apply those principles to remediation. And the last point, to support the development of green and sustainable remediation framework tools for addressing and promoting the sustainability in remediation practice in Italy and internationally. Next slide. The legislative decree 152 is the framework environmental legislation that, in addition to remediation of contaminated sites, covers also the environmental impact assessment, and the environmental liability, and many other environmental issues. Let's focus on some statements relative to remediation. Remediation should tend to treat soil on site and reuse it as filling material, reduce risk related to transport. The first two sentences would mean that off-site treatment or disposal should be left just as last choice. Let's focus on point 3 to point 5. Remediation should avoid any noises and odors, should adapt to landscape characteristics, and ensuring the achievement of the objectives, remediation should minimize the environmental impact. The last three principles sounds like the project manager should minimize the impacts of remediation activities on the environment. Next slide. After many years of considering soil from a contaminated site as a waste, the Italian Parliament tried to tackle this issue. In fact, reuse of excavated soil can be excavated soil from a contaminated site can be reused on site for construction activity if and it's not considered as waste if it's not contaminated, and it's not considered as waste if the leaching test is lower than a certain threshold. Then point number two, excavated soil can be considered as a byproduct and reused off-site if the concentration is lower than the screening level and the soil will be used in the same exposure scenario. For example, shallow soil from an industrial scenario used as shallow soil in another industrial site. And if the risk assessment determines an acceptable risk for the future destination. Then point number three, excavated soil can be reused on site if the site is a worked out mine, for example, for nourishment of slopes. Next slide. Now we face the water savings, that is another pillar of green remediation. In presence of contaminated groundwater, you should identify and use the best available technologies to treat the plume. The word identify would mean that you should take into account and evaluate different possibilities, of course. Point number two, if you use pump and treat, you should evaluate the use of extracted groundwater in the industrial cycle, for example, in the industrial process. Point three, treated groundwater are considered as industrial waters, and they can go in sewage, and they are not considered as a waste. Reinjection of treated groundwater can be authorized if the water will not contain harmful substances, and however, some substances can be authorized by control authorities, for example, surfactants or oxygen-releasing compounds. And then the last point, physical barriers are allowed only in few cases, for example, if you can get the objectives in any other way. Next slide. Another pillar of the green remediation is energy. We have 10% incentives for photovoltaic systems installed in replacement of asbestos containing material covers, and 5% incentives for ground-mounted photovoltaic systems on remediated sites. And if you have a look to, the incentives are in the form of additional price paid by the state for the energy produced. If you have a look on the table on the right side of the slide, you see that more than 20 square kilometers of photovoltaic system have been installed since 2000 to 2012. Unfortunately, incentives ended at July 2013, but it's under political debate the reintroduction of new incentives for renewable resources. Moreover, in 11 regions, 11 Italian regions, it's mandatory to install photovoltaic system on service station roofs. Next slide. So, as I showed in the previous slides, the legislators have done their part, but if we see this graph relative to soil remediation since 2000, we can discover that landfill disposal covered the 50% of site. The source of this data are the risk reduction measures implemented in the 39 national priority list sites. In the last years, we discover a growth of in situ technologies such as soil vapor extraction, while thermal treatment have not been reported. Next slide. As for groundwater, the situation is that containment is the main technology used. Containment comprehends both pump and treat and the physical barriers. As you can see, we have used the classification of the Federal Roundtable Technology Remediation of Remediation Technologies. Next slide. So, conclusion. Environmental regulation in Italy and globally includes provision for green practices. We have seen that most of the pillars of green and sustainable remediation are covered: soil reuse, water savings, waste reduction, and energy. Currently, remediation occurs mainly via traditional, more impacting technologies. We have seen 50% of landfill disposal, 45% of physical containment. Sustainable remediation frameworks, strategies, and tools can support the enhancement of environmental cleanup activities via increasing culture and consensus from project stakeholders. What miss is to put into practice the sustainable concept already acknowledged by the laws in force in Italy. Sustainable Remediation 2014 represents a great opportunity for remediation practitioners and the industry to learn and share best practice challenges and success stories to support sustainability at international level. Next slide. So we look forward to seeing you in Ferrara. Italy is not just Rome, Florence, and Venice, but it has a lot of beautiful cities, and I'm sure you will enjoy both the workshop and the city in Ferrara. See you there, and thank you to Carlos and Claudio.
Marco, thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation. And everybody allows me, we'll move on to the next speaker. We are running a little bit short on time, and to respect everybody. So next speaker is Alan Thomas. Alan is an environmental scientist with more than 20 years of experience in the management of contaminated sites, and he is helping embed sustainability in ERM's contaminated site management practices. So he's going to give us a little bit of his perspective based on a specific project his company has been involved in, and I believe Alan is speaking to us from the United Kingdom, if I'm correct. Thank you, Alan.
Hi, Carlos. Thanks very much. And my case study today is on a combined approach of high-resolution sulfurization coupled with in-situ thermal remediation as a means of sustainable remediation. It's a European case study that I'm presenting on behalf of the Nicole Sustainable Remediation Working Group. So thanks very much for the opportunity to talk to you all. I won't talk too much about the technical aspects of this site. Suffice to say that it's quite a complex site where chlorinated solvents were present in fractured bedrock. Pump and treat was originally envisaged as the solution for the site. And as I've mentioned, what we actually applied at the site was a thermally enhanced dual-phase vacuum extraction as the main kind of alternative. And we applied sustainability through the life cycle of the project. There are a number of kind of guidance documents available to assist with the framing of sustainable remediation. The Nicole roadmap was developed by the Nicole working group, which Dietmar introduced earlier. It provides a definition of sustainable remediation and also sets out a broad framework for the incorporation of sustainability management principles into contaminated land management, and is based on a two kind of stage approach. Initially looking at setting the remediation specification and strategy, and secondly then setting the remediation technical approach. We've kind of translated that into the kind of conventional site management process as illustrated here in really two kind of main phases. Setting the remediation specification and strategy takes into account those initial stages of the project through a definition of the project, site investigation, and up to risk assessment, really where we make the decision as to what the scope of the remediation is going to be. And then once we set the remediation technical approach, we really look at incorporating sustainability in remedial options appraisal, remediation construction, and optimizing the remediation system itself. A critical part of the project, I think, is at the outset when we define really what the key elements of sustainability really mean for the project itself. And a key part of that is identifying site-specific sustainability indicators that would include either environmental, social, or economic indicators. For the site in question, the indicators we developed were predominantly environmental and economic. And that really just reflected the industrial nature of the site. But a key social metric was the protection of human health. But what we also kind of considered a lot as well was the overall kind of boundaries of the project, in particular time scale and business objectives that really set the kind of hard framework around these environmental indicators. And the project boundaries had a significant effect, really, on the nature and scope of the remedial strategies that we actually developed for the site. As we mentioned, I think site investigation is a key element of the whole sustainable remediation life cycle, and we think a robust conceptual model really underpins sustainable solutions. At this site, we undertook a high-resolution site characterization approach and utilized a number of techniques, including the passive soil gas vapor survey, the use of a Waterloo profiler, as well as the use of a discrete fracture network testing for the bedrock aspects of the site. And some of these we've reported in other publications. But I think what we saw then in terms of primary benefits from this work is really allowing a revised iteration of the conceptual site model that enabled us really to get a much better understanding of the mass distribution, the contaminant flux, and geochemistry. This then in turn allowed us to refine and reduce the risks that were posed by the site. And I think then critically it reduced the area of treatment by approximately kind of 40%. And it allowed us to target areas of greatest mass for the aggressive source reduction. So there were a whole number of primary benefits that kind of flowed out of this detailed characterization work. And I think then we shouldn't kind of forget the secondary benefits from this approach as well. We certainly, I think, minimized the waste generated during the site investigation process. We eliminated multiple mobilizations as things were done in a very much on-site iterative process with lots of real-time data allowing us to refine the site investigation. That also had a knock-on effect then in terms of time on-site, manual handling, and, as I said, multiple journeys. And when we compared the works undertaken with a similar scope of works to get the same level of data using conventional site investigation, we estimated a much reduced kind of carbon footprint as well. So overall, I think it did demonstrate the importance of this site investigation and development of a conceptual model in underpinning sustainability. In terms of the remediation, I won't go into the detailed technical elements of the remediation, but suffice to say it was a steam injection project within a challenging geological, hydrological scenario. Very importantly, it achieved a very significant mass reduction in a very short time scale, which was one of the overarching kind of business objectives. And we also can kind of combine this aggressive source technology with post-treatment in-situ reductive dechlorination using emulsified vegetable oil as well. So we kind of combined the aggressive source technology with something far less aggressive to treat the plume post-treatment. We can consider sustainability in both the design and operation phases. We considered, for example, the use of surplus steam from the site as a heating source. We undertook extensive kind of instrumentation of the site that again allowed us to undertake real-time monitoring and therefore optimization of the heating cycle. And as I've already mentioned, then we also combined in-situ thermal with post-treatment bioremediation as a means of getting a balance right or optimizing really the, you know, the overall kind of technical approach. To try to quantify some of the benefits of this, we undertook a life cycle assessment calculation, and I know that's a subject of the following talk, so I won't go into this in detail, but I think suffice to say that it did provide quite a lot of valuable insight into the remediation that we undertook. I'm showing you the greenhouse gas emissions as one environmental indicator from the project, and you can see that the total emissions from the thermal treatment we undertook were actually less than what we kind of predicted if we'd assumed that the original pump and treat scenario had operated for a period of 15 years. But I think probably more important than just these numbers is kind of the insight really that this kind of approach can give to remedial design and optimization. And we were able to look at a number of various kind of sensitivity analyses, and this one really that I'm showing now is looking at the actual carbon footprint that we developed compared to the theoretical pump and treat scenario, which are the two columns on the left-hand side, compared then with the potential footprint if we'd basically not optimized the thermal treatment and allowed it to go for heating for 24 hours, 7 days a week. And then on the far right, the potential footprint if we hadn't actually optimized the extent of the treatment. So I think this life cycle assessment technology does allow you to kind of analyze these various kind of options, and I think can be particularly valuable, particularly in the planning stage as well as kind of retrospectively. So overall, the kind of conclusions from this kind of approach are that we believe the environmental footprint was significantly reduced compared to the original. It was certainly underpinned by a robust conceptual site model and the refined understanding of the risks. I think it allowed us to accurately delineate the source zone. We considered the use of existing energy sources. I think that, you know, would be a key component, but we also then try to optimize heat control and delivery, so really carrying that through not just in the design phase but in the actual operational phase, and I think polishing with the residual with in-situ bioremediation was also a significant kind of component as well. We were also looking to future innovation in our kind of thermal practice, a number of things that we'd highlight in including things like alternative energy supplies, links with other technologies. We're looking at energy recovery and really the benefits of low-temperature thermal treatment as well as a means of optimizing biological processes. And I think apart from the overall environmental benefits of the approach we've outlined, I think there was a broader business benefit, and we saw a significant reduction in life cycle costs, I think from an initial estimate of around 11 million to around 2.5 for the works that were completed. So I'd like to acknowledge colleagues in ERM who basically ran and managed this project, including James Baldock, Donald Reed, Simon Tilston, and Jay Dablo. Again, I'd like to thank Nicole for the opportunity to talk and present this case study on its behalf. Dietmar mentioned earlier the Common Forum joint position paper on sustainable remediation. I think that's a really important document, and I've provided a link to it there for anybody who's interested, and it is available in a number of languages. We also found the CLARE and SURF UK resources invaluable as well, including the list of environmental, social and economic indicators, and I provided a link to that for anyone interested as well. So thanks very much, and I'll pass back to Carlos.
Thank you, Alan. I enjoyed it very much. It's much appreciated. I appreciate the talk, and as with previous speakers, if you do have questions for Alan on his project or what Nicole is doing, please do use the Q&A box, but we'll have a Q&A session at the end of the webinar. I recognize we're going to run over a little bit. It's a very ambitious schedule, but we have a lot of information to share with you, and we're trying to do it in the minimum time possible. So with that, I'll hand it over to Paul Ferrara, who is our last speaker. Paul is Practice Director for Site Remediation and Revitalization at CH2M Hill. He has over 25 years of experience in site characterization, remediation engineering, and implementing clean remedies, and he's also a member of SURF US since 2007, where he served as president in 2008. Paul is speaking to us from what I assume is a warm Gainesville, Florida. Paul?
Right. Hey, Carlos, can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. And good morning and good afternoon and good evening to everybody. So why consider quantitation? I was asked to speak on quantitation. Well, the main purpose is for us to provide information to help us make better decisions. It'll help us identify opportunities to reduce contributions or negative impacts to the environmental footprint and also the societal and economic aspects of the project, too. It can also be used to estimate the relative benefits of best management practices. Carlos mentioned that earlier. And it can be used at any phase in the project life cycle. Probably the most applicable phases might be the remedy select phase, the design phase, and the optimization of an existing system. A reduction in environmental footprint often leads to lower costs, so a good economic reason for looking at quantitation. And I participate in SURF. I love the organization. I've been involved, as Carlos said, since 2007, and I'm glad we supported the ASTM Greener Cleanup Standard as well as the ASTM Integration of Sustainable Cleanup Objectives. And while my discussion is going to be focusing on the environmental attributes of footprint reduction, know that there's also work being done on the economic and societal aspects too, so quantitation can certainly be considered in that context and should be as well. This is a flowchart. A couple of people have mentioned the ASTM Greener Cleanup Standard. This is the stepwise process, and the green ovals on the left identify opportunities for quantitative evaluations and the different steps of the project lifecycle. And likewise, the ASTM method on integration of sustainable cleanup objectives also has a six-step process and has a loop where you can also consider quantitation in BMP. So quantitation certainly has a role in the overall assessment and integration of sustainable remediation. Here's a slide from Karen Schuerman that she presented on an EPA webinar a couple years ago that describes from an environmental standpoint all the attributes that go into a cleanup project. There's the on-site activities where we're doing the work on-site, whether it's well construction, treatment systems, extraction. And then there's a burden and impact associated with getting all that material to the site, primarily, you know, through transportation and conveyance. And then another component of the footprint that needs to be considered is off-site manufacturing. For example, the power supply, the fuel. We're using green substrates like cheese whey and emulsified vegetable oil, and there's a footprint associated with that too. So it's important to note that we not only need to consider the on-site activities, but also the transportation and the off-site materials that are being manufactured in the overall footprint. Carl's touched on this. There's footprint analysis tools, also life cycle assessment tools. The footprint tools are free. They're easy to learn. I think you can be pretty conversant and up and running in those in probably about 8 hours. And the most common tools, as Carlos mentioned, was SRT, SiteWise, and CIFA. If you want to do more analytical work and look at other potential impacts, life cycle assessment tools are available. The most commonly used today are SEMA Pro and Gabby. Those are expensive tools. They're not free, but there's a lot more robust analytical capabilities. But both tools are really very good for helping to, you know, estimate the footprint. I want to show you two case studies where we used footprint analysis to guide our work. One was Travis Air Force Base site DP-39, and we had a TCE plume that was about 2,000 feet long, and the source concentration was 8,000 ppb, and the aquifer thickness was 20 to 60 feet. And it was a kind of complicated geology, and there was basically 8 years of pump and treat at the site, and it really didn't accomplish anything. Once we, you know, stopped the pump and treat site, the contaminants rebound. And the FS proposed a greener remedy using a bioreactor, in situ solar powered bioreactor, phytoremediation, and biobarriers using emulsified oil injection. And we can compare that to the pump and treat system react processes. And this is a, you know, part of the footprint of that solar powered system. It's basically a solar powered well. I've got a profile. I won't talk ahead of the slide, but. But the remedy included the bioreactor, the barrier, and the phytoremediation. And this was actually highlighted as an EPA Region 9 case study. In over a 30-year operation cycle using pump and treat, we were able to show an estimated 1,000 metric tons of CO2 avoided, as well as a substantial amount of electricity avoided. And this is what the site looks like. It's you know, that's the solar power panels for the solar powered pumping well, and the way the system works is, I'm going to turn on my arrow here, I think. Gene, can you help me turn the arrow on? There we go. Thank you, Gene. So we dig out the overburden, and we replace it with a locally available mulch. This was produced on site, and then we put in some distribution piping and connect it up to a solar powered extraction well. In this case, it was side gradient. And the groundwater is extracted and distributed through the distribution piping. The water leaches through the substrate, the mulch, and dissolved organic carbon gets into the subsurface. And these numbers that we see here in each of the wells show the starting concentrations in red and the ending concentrations. And each of those numbers in between are basically six-month increments on sampling. So what we showed is with a, you know, a really green remedy, and of course in situ bioremediation is pretty green all by itself. We made it greener using a locally available mulch and a solar powered pumping well and applying a little recirculation, and we were able to accomplish something very quickly that we weren't able to do in 8 years of or 10 years of groundwater treatment. Another example I wanted to make everybody aware of and a real great opportunity to avoid footprint is material substitution. And we were looking at a site where we were looking at on-site solidification using a traditional pozzolan like cement and another one that was more sustainable. And the way we got to this is we were doing a design and we did bench scale studies with Portland cement, and when we did the footprint analysis, we realized there was a pretty big footprint associated with the cement. And we said, well, there's other ways to stabilize the soil, solidify it, and meet our strength goals. And so we did some research into greener pozzolans. And in this case, we looked at a number of pozzolans and went back to the treatability lab to find those that would meet our strength goals. And so with this, and it was a fairly, you know, big project, just by substituting Portland cement for a greener pozzolan, we were able to avoid, in our plan, 6,400 metric tons of CO2 emissions because cement has a fairly high footprint for for CO2 emissions. And then also the material, the greener pozzolan, was less expensive than the Portland cement, so we had a good cost reduction of about $125,000. So we wouldn't have gotten to this benefit had we not asked, can we make the alternative more sustainable? And I see there's a poll that was up there previously about the need for more case studies. I wanted to plug for our SURF organization how we've set up a new technical initiative to compile case studies. It'll be freely available on the SURF site once it's consolidated. And we're going to use a standard template, and we want to show the depth and breadth of successful applications, because it seems like, you know, based on that poll, surely a lot of people would like to see more applications. And here's an email link you can hit if you have anything that you would like to submit. And I hope you can consider adding to our body of knowledge in case studies. And that's it, Carlos.
Thank you very much, Paul, and I'm sorry we had to speed it up a little bit, but I think we're doing good on time. We're only 10 minutes over. With this, I'll hand it back to Gene, who will be moderating the questions, but if you have any questions about how to direct them, Gene, I'm on standby. Thank you very much. Gene?
Okay, great. Thank you. So just a gentle reminder, you all should see the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You can continue to type up and submit questions and comments for our speakers as we start to actually ask some of them out loud. I do have a few that have come in as we've gone throughout today's presentation. So I just wanted to start with a comment that came in regarding Dietmar's presentation. So we did have one participant who mentioned that the joint statement is also available in Spanish. And I didn't know, Dietmar, if you can comment, is that joint statement available in other languages as well? And Dietmar, if you're muted, you may need to hit #6 on your phone so that you can vocally respond.
Gene, do you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. No, the Spanish version is the most recent one. So there are 6 languages out there now.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Carlos, during your presentation, we had a question come in asking what PNT stands for.
I'm sorry, what's the acronym?
The question, what does P as in peer and T as in Tom stand for, PNT?
I'm going to have to look through it. I'll get back to you when I find it. I can't remember using
it. I think it's
pump and treat.
Oh,
I think you had it on one of your technology slides. Right, pump and treat.
PNT, yes, thank you. Thank you.
Claudio and Marco, this question came in during your session, but I actually think it was referring to one of the poll questions we showed. So, Carlos, you might also be able to help answer this one. One of our participants would like to know, what does L as in leopard, C as in cat, and A as in animal, L-C-A, stand for?
Okay, yeah, Paul and address that, but I'll hand it over to Paul.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, life cycle assessment. I use the acronym, and then I didn't go define it, but you talked about it more extensively, and so did Alan. If you want to mention anything else about life cycle assessment.
No, just, you know, there's a couple of common, you know, tools out there, and I was able to address it in the slide. I hope that answers the question.
Okay. Participants, if you have supplemental questions, you're certainly welcome to submit the further clarifying statements or additional elements to your question in the Q&A window. Paul, I'm going to turn the focus back to you. We've got 2 more questions from your session. One of our participants wants to know if you can define FF, so F as in Frank, S as in Sam.
I'm sorry, that's a feasibility study. It's the process we use, at least in the U.S., to evaluate alternatives.
Excellent. And then someone else wants to know if you could discuss the cost of the TCE bioreactor.
Oh, I don't have those numbers handy, but I do know that it was quite a bit less expensive than the pump and treat system there. I think for the system we put in there, it was on the order of a couple of $100,000, including several years of O&M, but as you can see, there's not a lot to it. There's basically excavation, creating some locally available mulch, the in-situ solar-powered well, and some distribution piping. So it's very low maintenance and low cost too.
Okay. Carlos, let's see. We have another question came in, and Paul, this is also for you. One of our participants states that Paul mentioned the use of cheese whey and emulsified oil in cleanup. They'd like you to clarify exactly how those products were used.
Yeah, sure. I can take that, Carlos. Those are used as a source of biological substrate. They, when they get into the ground, they, degrade into dissolved organic carbon that can be used by the indigenous microbes to help reduce chlorine and ethanes through dechlorination pathways. So it's we're using basically, food product, and some in the case of cheese whey, a waste food product, and using that to provide a source for organic carbon for the microbes to degrade the chlorinated ethanes.
Okay, I don't see any other questions that have come in electronically using the Q&A window in the lower right, but I did want to remind everyone we do have all of the various polls that have appeared on the throughout today's broadcast. We've pulled them all up, and you guys can continue to vote on some of these polls. Carlos, I don't know if you want to discuss a little bit some of the answers we're seeing, and we'll wait to see if any other questions come in.
Yes, thanks, Jean. I take the opportunity to thank everybody who's responded. It looks like we have about 100 answers for each poll, so about two-thirds of people are voting. That's a good. That's a pretty good turnout. And the first one is what does they represent? This is interesting to see. It looks like about 20% represent regulatory agencies, and folks like myself. The majority are with consulting and engineering companies, which is good. It's certainly one of the audiences we were hoping we would reach. Those are folks doing the work in the field. We want them to understand where regulators are coming from and also what the state of the practice is, and share those experiences. Contaminated site owner manager, about 10% of participants, and that seems to be consistent with other webinars we have had. And then municipality or other government agencies, in other words, not necessarily environmental regulators, they're often the ones that are overseeing a lot of these cleanups. Have you applied green remediation best management practices? I was pleasantly surprised. We're at about 50-50, so 52 to 48 folks have responded yes. Versus no, so that's pretty good. I was surprised. I thought it would be lower there. Have you conducted an environmental footprint? That's also consistent with what I guess we could expect. About 30% have done so, about 70% haven't. We don't expect that number to necessarily shift that much because we're not suggesting that environmental footprint or LCA is necessary at every site. It is valuable at larger sites. So that's pretty consistent with what we would have expected. It seems like 58% of participants think the case studies would help facilitate an expansion and implementation of green sustainable remediation practices, and 64% believe that access to tools such as standards, footprint quantification tools, et cetera, would help. And finally, it looks like I think there was one more question on the top right there. It looks like about 14 folks are planning on attending the conference in Ferrara, about 70%, 72% are not. This webinar was intended as a preview of, not a preview, but also to set up some of the thinking and some of the themes of what will be discussed in Ferrara. We believe that there is value in participating in this webinar, even if you don't go to Ferrara. But if anybody does go, these topics will be expanded, and we'll go into more depth at the actual conference in September. So that's the summary synopsis ahead of the feedback from the audience. I appreciate the people taking the time to vote. And I hand it back to you, Jean.
All right, thank you, Carlos. We did have one additional question come in. And I'll just shoot this to your direction, Carlos, because it doesn't seem to be directed at a particular speaker. One of your participants wants to know where phytoremediation sits in the whole concept of green remediation.
Okay, thanks, Jean. I'll fall back on An analogy I used early in the early years of green remediation with respect to phytoremediation, remediation, because that question does come up quite often. And, you know, the suggestion is, well, trees are green. What could be greener than trees or, you know, for and used in phytoremediation? So I use that to put an example. It's not a matter of what remediation technology we use, but how that remedy is implemented. In the case of phyto, you could have one project where going to the extreme where we use a species that could be invasive, that has low ecosystem attributes, that requires pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers, and requires intensive irrigation, and it's phyto remediation. We could have another project where we have a native species that requires no pesticides, no herbicides, no fertilizer, low irrigation. We keep the ground covered so there's no surface runoff. It still does the same job as far as phyto remediation is concerned, but this is a true green remediation phyto project. So I hope that helps clarify. It's not about the technology or the remedy, but how the remedy is built, is implemented and operated. Thanks for the question, Doug.
Okay, well, with that, I don't see any other questions, just some thanks from the audience for hosting the session. So let me walk everybody through a few final reminders before we close things out today. As Carlos mentioned, I wanted to thanks to the nearly 150 people who joined us from around the world for today's live broadcast, as well as the number of presenters who were actually able to join us today from locations across the globe. As we mentioned today, we are going to provide an archived copy of today's webinar, so you all will receive a follow-up email in approximately 1 to 2 weeks as soon as the recorded version of today's webinar is available for free download or replay. There are links to download copies of the presentation materials as well as to take a look at our short feedback form. I will ask each of the participants to take a moment and fill out that feedback form. I do read each and every one of the comments, and your comments do greatly help us to continue to deliver sessions like the one that you participated in today. If you participated with a group at one location, each person can actually fill out their own copy of the feedback form list or feedback form. You simply fill it out, and then there will be a link to let another person hop on and fill out their form on their own. For those of you that are looking to document your participation for credit or training purposes, when you fill out that feedback form online, there's a box that's circled in red on this slide that if you check that box, as long as your email address is entered correctly, we will send you a confirmation email to your email address that will at least verify you shared feedback after the live delivery. This process will also work for those of you that are replaying the archived version. Many participants find those confirmation emails helpful to help document their attendance today. Again, we will keep copies of the presentation materials available to download from this point forward. So for those of you that need it, you'll find it on the seminar resources or links page. Those are available on the right side, as well as I've posted them into the Q&A window as well. I think that's the end of all the reminders that I have for today. Again, my great thanks to all of you who were able to join us for our live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live session. Thank you, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Jean.